It's time for another edition of On Your Money with information and advice on your personal finances with financial planner Kevin McKinley. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I hope you will join in with your questions on anything and everything relating to your money, from paying for a college education and whether it's a good idea or not for parents to pick up the tab, and whether it's wise to buy a prepaid funeral. And we'll also have more on our New Year's resolution series on the dollars and cents of buying home gym equipment. If you have any other questions about your money, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, joining us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin. Cold enough for you, Kevin?
good morning, Joy.
We have a wind chill advisory going on. I hope you have some warm socks on or something.
That's all I have on, actually. And it doesn't seem to be doing the trick, so I think I'm going to add some more clothing as the show goes on here. Sorry for
Thank
all
you.
Of you getting a mental image out there.
I hope you do that. Well, Kevin, once I get that out of my mind, before we get started with our first topic, our first topic is going to be on a new study on college costs and grades, but I wanted to put out the word to listeners that we are thinking of starting this new regular segment during On Your Money, where you, Kevin, play financial judge and help resolve some sort of financial disagreement between spouses or partners. I suppose it could even be friends, but like, should a couple buy a big expensive new item or should they save that money? Or should a big purchase be financed with money coming out of savings, or should they take out a loan? Any money dilemma or conflict or disagreement that our listeners might be facing with another listener, we would love to hear from you. We would love emails at onyourmoney@wpr.org. And especially we want people who might be willing to come on, two of you, come on in an arranged phone call each week for this proposed segment. Kevin, you have talked about in the past that you deal with these types of financial conflicts all the time, and you do this frequently because didn't you say that we tend to marry people who have very different money management philosophies?
Yeah, spenders usually are attracted to savers and vice versa. And actually, it's healthy because hopefully together, especially in a couple, the two of you complement each other. And while one says, hey, let's go to Puerto Rico and right now because it's 20 below zero, the other one says, well, we don't have any money to do that, so let's just turn the thermostat up a little higher. And on the other hand, someone says, you know, we only have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars and we're getting more in Social Security than we ever had in earnings. I'm still afraid we're going to go broke. The other person can say, you know, we're going to be okay, and we'll survive, and we've lived on a lot less and spent a lot more than we have to spend right now. But the problem is that any kind of relationship, whether it's romantic or work-related or even with friends and siblings, money is an easily quantifiable problem. You can tell right away who's put in more and who's put in less into it, or what is something going to cost. And people have very different philosophies about the value and worth of spending money on something versus not spending it. And so, yeah, I'm very judgmental anyway. So I'm really happy to talk with you about any questions you have. And this is actually something that we really do work a lot with more in my private practice. Obviously, there are things like, you know, should I save more for retirement? How much can I save? Can I realize any capital gains this year at a favorable level? But more so, people say, you know, I really want to sell the home we're in, and I want to buy a smaller place, or we really think it's a good idea to pay for all of our kids' college because I don't want her to worry. My husband says that we shouldn't do that, that we can't afford it, or it's just not good for her. So, yes, those kinds of dilemmas and questions, please contact us any way you can, and we'll talk about how we can help you. It will remain as anonymous as we can keep it. And, again, we actually won't judge you, but we'll give you our recommendation.
Yeah, sounds good. And we'll call it Ask Judge Kevin or something like that. I'm not sure yet. But if you'd like to take part in this possible new segment where you will ask Kevin to help you decide whether you spend that money or save it or whatever the dilemma might be, send us an email at onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can call 1-800 1-800-642-1234, and you can give producer Cynthia Schuster your contact information. And hopefully we can put this segment together for a future on your money and make it a regular thing, we hope. Well, let's talk about this just in, a newly released study, Kevin, that says that if a parent pays for all of their child's college education, that could lead to said child's lower grades in college?
That's right. UCal Merced, a sociology professor, Laura Hamilton, and I have to give this woman credit. You know how many researchers and academic people, when they're doing studies, will go, you know, they'll go live in the wilds of Africa to study chimpanzees or something, or they'll, you know, they'll go stay in Antarctica for 9 months living in weather even worse than we have right now, trying to study the effects of climate change. Well, this woman really made a total commitment to her study, her profession, and spreading the information. She actually went to live on a college dorm floor.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I hope she was paid hazard pay for that. But she watched what all these kids did and then was very surprised. She saw that a lot of them who were struggling to actually pay for school and were taking out lots of loans, some of them seemed to be doing better in school than ones whose parents were paying for the full load. And so she decided to quantify the study and do it using actual statistics rather than observations. And she found that the more that parents were putting in of their own dollars, both in terms of dollars and share of cost towards the cost of college, those students were more likely to graduate, but they were more likely to get lower grades than those who were scrambling to pay for things versus working, borrowing money, etc.
So why did the researchers think this was the case?
Laura's thoughts were that the kids have less skin in the game. If they're not paying for anything whatsoever, therefore they're less likely to, she's less likely to apply herself at school and more likely just to have fun. It might be a little bit of a chicken and egg situation, though, or causation and correlation problem, because when families of lower income or lesser means have a student who is really good, they're going to move heaven and earth to try to get her into college, whereas higher income families with more resources are obviously just going to be more likely just to send the kid to college and say, look, you may not be ready for this, but it's what you should do right now. So we're going to do everything we can to get you in there and we'll pay for it, but you need to work. And the student who's going to be have more brains than money and more aptitude is probably going to work a little harder maybe than the one who says, you know what? What do I care? This isn't costing me anything. I think I'll have 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years of fun.
So what should we glean from this research in the interest of increasing the responsibility of our children, our college students? Should parents avoid paying for their kids' college education?
Not if they can help it, but I think there is a manner in which they should use to pay for the expenses. First of all, I do believe in borrowing money, even if you don't need it for college expenses, and borrow in the student's name, and then use savings last for the last couple of years of school, law school, grad school, med school, whatever afterwards. If the loans aren't very attractive by the time the kid goes on to advanced education, if you will, or there might be a family emergency that comes up. Let's say you've got $40,000 set aside for kids' college education. And after the kid's junior year, you lose your job. Well, if you've got the $40,000, you can use that to pay the bills, and the kid can hopefully borrow money to pay for those other college expenses. But if you spend it on the first few years of school, it's very difficult, obviously, to go back to the school and say, hey, remember when we gave you all that money? Could we get that back and then get a retroactive loan or something?
Well, you know, Kevin, back in my day, besides walking to school, 5 miles, I held down like three part-time jobs. And I don't mean to brag. I know things are a lot different today. But what about a student working to help pay for college?
Well, part of it, you had more time because I know this because I went to the same kind of school you did. It was a one-room college.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to walk around all the time up and down hills, some snowbanks and everything. You just moved to one corner for an entirely different lecture. Yeah, I think it's a good idea for kids to work while they're going to school if they can find a job that's very lucrative and or applies in their field of study. For say, let's say a student wants to be a veterinarian, he gets a job at a veterinary practice. That's fantastic. Good experience, good connections, everything. But otherwise, a job slinging shots of Jägermeister or whatever at 3 o'clock in the morning, that kid may be better off spending time at school and studying and taking a bigger course load. If he takes a lower course load because he has more time that he's working, it takes him longer to graduate, and it obviously could affect his grades because he doesn't get as much time to study. So I'd rather have people borrow money for the kid or the kid borrow money than get the job. And back in our day, there was a study where the University of Minnesota said that in 1968, a student could work 300 hours in a year or 6 hours a week at minimum wage to pay for tuition costs. Right now in 2012, that same kid making minimum wage has to work 1,200 hours a year or about 22 hours a week to pay for tuition. So the value of working is probably less now than it was in our day.
Yeah, times have changed. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And with that being said, if you have a question for Kevin, be it about paying for a college education or anything else, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And a listener named May wonders if she should cash out her life insurance to prepay funeral expenses. Kevin, is that a good idea?
I'm not crazy about either idea, but I'm even less excited about combining the two. I understand the need, and she's probably getting encouraged to do this by somebody, but no, I don't think this is the best idea in the world.
Well, so what's wrong with cashing out the life insurance for something like this?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it inherently. If she needs the money, if she has some more urgent needs coming up that she could spend that on rather than borrowing it or cashing in other investments that are more valuable. But once she does this, the earnings on the life insurance policy, if there are any, will be taxed as ordinary income. Plus, of course, there's a loss of the death benefit, and that death benefit can be tax-free to the heir. So depending on her life expectancy, there may be a lot more money for the estate and tax-free if she waits and keeps it in place. And in a lot of these policies, you know, we were kind of, for many years, the interest rates on some of these cash value policies were so low, they weren't looked upon as a good investment. I don't think they're a great investment, but the interest rate paid is fairly competitive right now in this very low interest rate environment. So all things being equal, if she's had the policy a long time and she can't afford the premiums, I'd just as soon have her keep that in place.
So it would be better to use the proceeds than it would be for prepaying for a funeral now.
Yeah, that's right. I would rather, well, you know, when she dies, that's when she's going to need the money for the funeral. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully the policy will be in place and it will kick in. And then the heirs or whoever's the executor of the estate can use those proceeds to pay for the funeral expenses. Plus, the notion of prepaying for a funeral, it's something that often is encouraged by funeral planners or funeral directors, and I'm a big fan of that. I do think that you should make plans for your funeral or cremation or whatever have you, and do it with a funeral director if that's what you want. But don't prepay it. I'd rather have you just put the money into a checking account. If you need to make some mental compartmentalization, do that. But just put it in there, and then if you need the money for something else in the meantime, or you change your mind about what you want done after you're gone, that money will still be there, and you can use it however you want.
Yeah, I've heard the pitch that, hey, if you pay now, it's $10,000. If you wait until you actually pass away, it might be $20,000, and you don't want to do that to your heirs.
Well, no, and that can be true, and it also can be true that in some cases this pitch is made as, you know, if you prepay for your funeral, it gets out of your attachable assets for Medicaid. And again, the dollar amount is so small on an aggregate basis that I'd just as soon keep it there. You know, a lot of people are choosing, we just read about this and we'll talk about it. More people are choosing to be cremated than to be buried in the state of Wisconsin last year for the first time. And that's as that evolves, so might your plans for your eternal remains.
If you have a question for Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Dave in Wanakee is with us first. Hello, Dave.
Yes, hello. I'm going to be selling my house in the spring, and I was wondering, how do you pick out the best realtor?
Advice on picking a realtor, Kevin.
That's tough to do, and because it's a very, you know, there are some who are really hardworking and diligent, and then there are others, this is true with any profession, there are others who, you know, just they have a hard time reaching and getting hold of. What I would look at is look at someone who has a lot of listings and whose name you see coming up. Look for someone who has an expertise either in the area, the geographic area, or the type of home you're selling. You know, is it a farm? Is it a multifamily? And finally, talk to people who have had homes sold recently. If you have some friends and say, I've got somebody in mind, but if you had a really good or bad experience, someone I should watch out for, please let me know. But definitely get everything in writing and give yourself some outs in terms of time as to how long the realtor will represent you, because some, and again, this is definitely not all, there are a lot of good ones out there, but some people are more interested in getting the listing and then the RX in getting the house sold for you. So try to find someone who's been in the business a while and has a lot of other listings, so they're really committed to what they're doing and is going to be on top of it. Make sure you communicate what you're looking for. You know, if you're looking to get the highest price, it's probably going to take a long time to sell it, if ever. If you say, I'm looking to get this done in a hurry, I want to get a good price, but I want to get it done by a certain date, make sure they know about it so they know where you're coming from.
Do you have any thoughts, Kevin, on whether someone should do the for sale by owner thing versus having a realtor?
It depends on the time and the energy. If you're the kind of person, you know, you like to do your own taxes and you manage your own investments and you've got some time and interest and you don't, you know, mind doing all of the work, you can hire a lawyer to do a lot of the paperwork, and it will usually be less expensive than a realtor. And sometimes it's nice to do that first and see what happens. Maybe, you know, you can sell the house in a hurry, save a few $1,000s. But again, if you prefer to pay someone to do work that you would just as soon not do, the realtor is hopefully going to have a lot more connections, a lot more exposure in the MLS system for you than you can get on Craigslist and some other ones. So you're probably going to want to, if you do that, do it first, but don't plan on being in a permanent solution. Plan on going to a realtor after you, if you can't sell the house for the price you're looking for.
And Dave, I missed it. You're not leaving us, are you? Or are you just moving to another place in Wisconsin?
No, I'm moving to a nicer place downtown.
Oh, good, good. I'm just glad that you're still going to be listening to Wisconsin Public Radio in Wisconsin. Thanks for the call. Our next caller is Umar in Milwaukee. Hello. Hello,
hi.
Umar. You're on the air. What's your question?
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Joe. I have a Edwards College Fund. It's been there for 10 years, and it has all the money that I put in plus $1,000. I'm wondering if it is worth the investment, or I can just roll it over to a Roth IRA and make it more useful. Thank you.
All right. Wait, hold on, Umar. Did you catch all that, Kevin?
He's not happy with the investment performance in the 529 college fund.
Yes.
Did I get that correct?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's not uncommon. It's nothing wrong with the EdVest program. The EdVest is a college savings plan that's licensed by the state of Wisconsin and then outsourced to several different money managers. And there are probably close to 50 different state-sponsored college savings plans like this. Usually what the problem is not so much the Edvest, but it's the investments underlying. And with an Edvest, you can choose from a roster of different investment options ranging from, you know, very safe and very boring money market and CDs, all the way up to, you know, very aggressive mutual funds, much like you can with a 401k or a Roth IRA, like Umar mentioned. I don't know that I would take the money out of it because of the investment performance. What I'd rather have you do is, if you do take it out, look at it from a financial aid standpoint. Umar, how old is the child for whom you are saving?
Seven.
Okay, so we've got about 10, 11 years until that money's going to be needed. And this would be a Roth IRA for you? That's what you're thinking about moving the money to?
No, I can use it for the child, but just that it'll be more flexible.
Yeah, you do get a little more flexibility within the Roth IRA, but have you been in a very conservative investment option for the past few months or years, Umar?
I haven't done anything with the 529. I just put in the money and the Edvest program chose the option for me.
Okay, did they choose it based on the child's age?
Yes.
So okay. That's how that
and
works,
And that's a
Kevin?
Good option. It can be an option. You pick, it's one of the options where the portfolio gradually gets more conservative as the child nears the age of 18. And I think that's a great option. I don't blame the Edvest program itself. There are a lot of investments out there that have not great. But again, we're in a fairly low return environment going forward, I think. And sometimes a low return might be better than what could happen. But I also think that, If you've been using a plan for many years and you're not happy with it, switching it to a different investment probably isn't going to help, especially because the stock prices are the highest they've been in, 4 or 5 years. So you might be moving out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thanks, All right. Umar, very much. So, Kevin, that's how the 529s work, is that you want to put this investment in there and then the investment counselor there will say, hey, let's put it in this fund rather than that fund?
You usually get the help with your own investment advisor, or you mm-hmm. choose it your own, but yes, they have a roster of several different accounts and investment options, and you can switch between them. There are some limitations as to how often you can do that, but you can move it around. But it's usually the age-based one is a good autopilot one to go into and just start out relatively aggressive and then have it become more conservative as time goes on.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. You can call in with your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, onyourmoney@wpr.org. Next, we go to George in Milwaukee. Hello, George.
Yes, good morning. Question regarding graduate school for my 28-year-old daughter, who is no longer a dependent. But I'm wondering if you've got any suggestions, because I'm anticipating that she's going to have to take out some hefty loans in order to get through graduate school, even if she gets some help from the college. Any suggestions on the kinds of loans she might be able to apply for? We also have some savings of our own that we could possibly, send her away, maybe out of some IRAs. I'm not sure. Any thoughts on this?
Well, are you fully committed to doing whatever you can to help her, or are you a little hesitant about how much you actually kick into this endeavor?
I think that we would help her out to a minor extent.
Okay. Do you own your own home?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a mortgage on it?
No.
Okay. This is going to seem counterintuitive to the people who have come to the show today and recently. But if you said, hey, we'll do whatever we want, whatever we can to help her out, and, mm-hmm. and what would you want us to do, I'd say go out and get a new 30-year mortgage and get it for as much as the lender will allow, because that is going to be the cheapest source of funds for your family. And you can even loan it to her, Dennis. You could say, all right, let's say your house is worth $100,000. You could borrow $80,000 at 3.5% interest for 30 years, possibly get a tax deduction on the interest payment, and have a new payment that's about maybe, $400 a month, maybe. And then I would take the proceeds of that and actually loan it to her if you think she can repay you and you think she's a good risk. And you can loan it to her at 4 or 5% or something if you want. And that's probably going to be a lower interest rate than what she will pay, especially if she has to go out in the private loan market. Now, that said, if you can't quite get your arms around that, then the next best thing is for her to get all the federal loans that she possibly can. And she should do that by filling out the FAFSA, the FAFSA.ed.gov. That's the federal government aid. Have you done that before with her?
Yeah, as an undergraduate, I didn't know it was available for graduate school.
Yeah, it's available, and it's the quickest way. We'll talk about it a little bit later today, but it's the easiest way, or it's the first step anyway, in getting just about any kind of financial aid. So I would definitely want her. I'll put a link up to it at onyourmoney.com where she can go to get started and kind of bypass some of the stuff, go right to the grad school financial aid issues. But, yeah, I definitely would want if you're comfortable getting the mortgage, I think it's a great deal. But if you're not, I understand. And then I'd want her to get as much federal financial aid as she possibly can get, even if it means student loans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, George. Kevin, if George has paid off his mortgage on his house already, will a bank give you a new 30-year mortgage on a house that's already paid for?
Yeah, with some income or assets and very, standard credit. You don't have to have a stellar credit score, but you have to have a good credit score. And usually people who have paid off their homes have a very good credit score. So, yeah, I all the things being equal, if I could wave a magic wand, that's the way I would prefer to do it. I'm a big fan of people monetizing equity in their homes as long as they use it responsibly and don't fritter it all away. And with interest rates so low and loan interest rates on student loans being relatively high right now and a little harder to get than mortgages for some people, I'd just as soon go with the path of least resistance. And in his case, that's probably the mortgage.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money, and it's time now for Smart Assets. And we've been giving you the latest tax figures that may affect you in 2013. And today, we're going to talk about some figures that might raise or lower what you pay in taxes. What's up, Kevin?
Well, let's start with the standard deductions. Those are one of the many tax figures that are bumped up for inflation. And it's $6,100 for singles in 2013 and $12,200 for married couples filing jointly. These are the numbers that you automatically get. And then if you can itemize deductions that exceed those amounts, probably better to itemize. But otherwise, you're going to get a standard break of those dollar amounts. Plus, you'll get exemptions for just about every member of your immediate family of $3,900 for 2013. And there's been an increase, as we alluded to last week, in the income figures for the various federal income tax brackets, like the 15% bracket and 25% bracket. And what I'm guessing is that a lot of people, unless they had a big bump in their income, probably won't see a bigger income tax bill on the federal level and may pay even less in federal taxes this year than they did last year.
We've talked about the alternative minimum tax before. Are there any changes there?
Yeah, those are also good ones. That was a big piece in the legislation that was just passed at the end of the year. The alternative minimum tax, technically every taxpayer has to figure their taxes in two different forms, the way that we're used to doing it, and then via the alternative minimum tax. Then you have to pay the higher of the two. A lot of people are not caught by the alternative minimum tax, but more and more people have been so. And the alternative minimum tax is kind of, when people talk about, gee, I really wish we had a flat tax in place. Well, the flat tax actually is very much like the alternative minimum tax. There's a higher level of income excluded from taxation, but once you start getting taxed, the rate is higher, and you lose a lot of deductions. So you generally are going to see it, and not only is the income level, the floor for which the income would be subject to the AMT, raised up to $50,000 or so for singles and $80,000 for married couples filing jointly, but also it's going to be indexed upward for inflation in the future. Before it hadn't been, and so it kept catching more people, and so Congress would have to go back in and basically manually adjust the numbers upward. Now they'll be moved upward with inflation.
And we've also discussed Social Security taxes over the past few weeks. Are there other Social Security tax changes that we ought to know about?
Yeah, good news. You can earn more money now if you're collecting Social Security but under normal retirement age and still not lose any benefits. These are people who are age 62 to 66, meaning they're eligible for Social Security and they take it, but they're under normal retirement age, which is 66 right now. In 2013, you can earn up to $15,120, still collect your Social Security, and no loss of benefits whatsoever. And again, this is only your earnings. If you're married, your spouse's earnings don't count. Passive earnings like interest doesn't count either. Now, if you go over that dollar amount, you lose a dollar in Social Security benefits for every $2 over that amount. But still, you'd have to make quite a bit to lose all the benefits, and most people are making enough where they would lose a lot of their benefits. Shouldn't be taking Social Security anyway and don't need it. So it usually aren't affected. And even if you do lose some of the benefits, you still may get that back in the future in the form of a higher Social Security check down the road.
So what about tax increases, Kevin? We haven't really talked a whole lot about that over the past few weeks. Who's going to be paying more in taxes?
It's actually, other than the one we discussed a couple weeks ago about the Social Security, the payroll tax just being raised back up to where it was previously before the President Obama's tax holiday was put in. That's just back to where it was and where it was supposed to be. There wasn't a lot of political support to keep it in place. So the average American full-time worker is going to have about $1,000 more in Social Security taxes taken out of her check every single year. Otherwise, the people who are going to get hit are generally upper income earners, singles making $200,000 or more, married couples filing jointly who make $250,000 or more. And these little incremental hits are going to hurt them, but it's only on the income generally that they make above the 200 and 250 and 400 to 450 levels. So unless you're, you know, in the top 2% of income earners, you probably won't see any changes whatsoever to your taxes other than the payroll tax.
If you have a question for certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Dennis in Springfield Corners. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning. Explain to me the concept of the reverse mortgages that I've been hearing about on TV. What are the advantages and disadvantages? And I've heard horror stories where people get kicked out of their homes. I'll jump off and listen on the radio now.
Do people get kicked out of their homes in those things, Kevin?
Usually not. And there have been a couple isolated incidents, but these reverse mortgages are advertised much more heavily. By the way, this is one of those commercials that if I see it on being broadcast on a show that I'm watching, I start to question whether or not this is a show I really need to be watching. You know, some of these, you know, have you been in a lawsuit? Is the IRS after your money? All those kinds of commercials. I go, you know what? Maybe I want to associate with a higher level of viewers here. But it seems like these are everywhere. You can't avoid them. A reverse mortgage is eligible to homeowners who are over the age of 62. And if it's a married couple, one of the owners has to be over 62. And you can basically get money from your home in the form of about 70% of the accumulated equity. You do it without any application. There's not a traditional loan application. You don't have to have any income for it. You just have to have equity. And you can take it in a lump sum. You can take it in the form of a home equity line of credit. Or you can take it in the form of a monthly payment. And let's say a person says, all right, I have a $100,000 home. It's paid for, but I want to do a reverse mortgage. I'm over 62. You talk to a counselor first, and then once the counselor says yes, you're good to go. You can get probably about $60,000 to $70,000 back in the form of a tax-free check with no application whatsoever. Then all you have to do is maintain the home, meaning you have to pay the property taxes and do the normal upkeep. You don't have to, you know, replace that god-awful carpeting in the living room, but you do have to make sure that the roof is in good shape. And you can stay in the home for as long as you want. You can stay there forever. It's only after you've left the home for at least 12 months, and that could be by passing away or going to a nursing home or moving to another residence. Then what happens is the lender sells the home. And if the lender sells the home for more than what your reverse mortgage has accumulated to, you or your estate actually gets the net proceeds. If the lender sells the home for less than what you owe on the reverse mortgage, though, you and your estate owe nothing. You don't get your home, but you don't owe anything at all. And this is a very good tool. It's a little scary for some people. I get that. But it's a very good tool for people who are house rich but cash poor and are wondering how they can stay in their home and still pay for life and all the other things that that they have to cover.
Well, it sounds good for some people, but under what rare circumstance would somebody get kicked out of their home?
Usually it's when they haven't kept it up. Sometimes in the cases I think he's referring to are cases where one of the spouses took out a reverse mortgage and without the knowledge of the of the other spouse, and then for one reason or another didn't get a sign on for it. AARP had a pretty in-depth series about the dangers of that, but no, in terms of people actually getting kicked out of their home just for the heck of it, that can't happen as long as you adhere to the fairly low-stress covenants of the agreement.
Coming up during this edition of On Your Money, we will continue our series on New Year's resolutions. A lot of us say we want to get in better shape or we want to lose weight and that we want to do better financially. So we kind of combine those, and we will get some tips on how to save money when you're buying home exercise equipment. Plus more answers to your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop around.
And this is our Shop Around segment. As a part of our series on spending less, why you lose more weight, we thought it would be good to discuss how to save money when you're buying home exercise equipment. And Kevin, you mean that's a good idea to buy home exercise equipment?
Yeah, if you're going to use it and you have the room for it without disrupting your feng shui of your home too much, it can save lots of time and money. First of all, you get to use it whenever you want, not when it's available or when the club in question is open. There's no waiting for it. You get complete privacy. You don't have a bunch of people looking at you while you sweat all over the place or fall off the treadmill. And finally, you know, if you spend money on a two-year gym membership, let's say at $50 a month, that's $1,200 over 2 years. And for $1,200, you can get a very good treadmill, elliptical, bike, whatever, weight machine, and you've got that forever. And yes, it's only one piece of equipment, but if you're going to use it and it makes you more likely that you use it, it's a very good investment.
Yeah, and the reason I was just teasing about that was so many times, and I'm guilty of it too, I have some exercise bike down in my basement that hasn't been used in 20 years now because I just didn't like it.
Mm-hmm. It didn't take you where you wanted to go, right?
And people do that all the time. They use their treadmills as clothes hangers and that sort of thing. You just got to make sure that you're going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you start?
Yeah, ask friends. Tell them, see people say you're working out. People are, very glad to go into long detail about their regimen, whether it's yoga or whatever. Ask them if they have a machine that you use in home that you really like, and not only will you find out which ones are being used amongst your peer group, but also you might get a chance to even to check it out, try it out, and see if it's right for you. Otherwise, Consumer Reports has a wonderful section on fitness equipment. A lot of the stuff on there is free at consumerreports.org, and it's well worth the $30 or whatever for membership to get the very detailed ratings on not only exercise equipment, but all other kinds of spending things. And then finally, you can go to Amazon.com, and you'll not only see a ton of different machines advertised there, but you have, again, people more than willing to go into lengthy detail about their experience with this machine, how many stars they'd rate for, what they liked, what they didn't like. And people will even give updates on it. Okay, I've owned this for a year, and here's what I like now and what I don't like. So Amazon's a really great place to research a lot of these machines.
Oh, great. So after you do all that research online, you might find a device that you do want to buy. What do you recommend in terms of what should we be thinking about at that point?
Well, this is a good time that even if you do find something you like at Amazon and it seems to be fairly priced, you may still want to buy local, because then you can, you know, on Amazon you might get a postage stamp size picture of it. If you go to a local store, you can not only see it, but you can measure it, you can try it out, you can see what it would look like and get a better idea of what it would like in the particular spot that you have it. And more importantly, once you do find one that you buy, you get better service usually if something goes wrong, especially if you buy from an actual fitness place like, you know, Shields or another sporting goods store. What's even more important with these big machines, though, definitely spend the money. This is one of the best investments I can recommend here. Spend the money on getting the machine not only delivered to your home, but brought into the exact space in which you want it and finally installed correctly. Even if it's $100, $200 or whatever, it's well worth the cost to have it done right. And more importantly, you're probably getting this because you're not in great shape. You won't strain yourself lifting 100 or 200 pounds worth of equipment up and down the stairs.
So any other tips for those who might be outfitting their own gyms?
Yeah, sure. Definitely go for sturdy and well-built over flash. A lot of those programs that, you know, there's 286 different programs, people end up not using those. And the more of those there are in the machine, the more likely they are to malfunction, which may wreck the whole machine for you. See if you can get a trial period from the retailer. Say, if I don't like this, what's the process for you getting it back out of my house and taking it home and giving me a credit? Definitely read and save the warranty. And as part of this, a lot of times you'll be asked or strongly suggested that you purchase the extended warranty on the equipment. And I don't mind you buying that if it makes you feel good, but like most insurance, it's something that you'll pay for and probably not need. So it's usually not a good investment for people unless, again, it makes you sleep better at night.
Sounds good. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Back to the phones now, and Robert in Hayward is with us. Hello, Robert.
Good morning, Kevin. I appreciate and need your humor right now. Both my kids earn most of their money going through college, but yikes, they're both getting married this summer.
Not to each other, right?
Yeah. No, right. Right.
Okay, good, good.
To help finance their weddings, my wife and I would like to help them, but we don't exactly agree. Should we refinance our mortgage from 3.87 to a lower rate, convert my mutual fund to a Roth IRA, and gift a portion of that IRA to both? Or should I sell the love of my life, not my wife, but my second love of my life, my mint condition one owner 73 Dodge Power Wagon?
Oh, no. Robert.
Nope, we're just getting emails in right now with offers to buy that car, Robert. And, oh, we've got one offer in here to buy your wife in case that doesn't work out, too. So, I think it's a great question. Let me ask you this, Robert. Are these children of yours, I know you have to kind of support them, and even if, you know, they're not doing things exactly the way you might choose for them, are they fairly frugal, or is this one of those things where, you know, they're looking at hiring the Royal Lipizzan Stallions to bring the bride in, or?
They are both very reliable. They're both self-employed, and, I mean, not self-employed, but they're doing very well, and they have pretty much wanted to finance most of it themselves, but we'd like to help.
Okay, here's one way I would help, and this would be good advice for all parents there who do want to help but also want to keep it within reason. Tell the kids, pick a figure that you're comfortable with. Say, here, we're going to give you $5,000 for your wedding. If you want to spend $25,000, we don't recommend that, but you're going to have to find the $20,000 difference someplace else. And if you go down to the courthouse and get married for $200, guess what? You've got $4,800 to do whatever you want. And that's a great way to let them decide what's important to them. Is the money more important, or is the big celebration whatsoever? By the way, just as a word of advice out there, I know someone who has done hundreds and hundreds of weddings for people, and he has a correlation that the bigger the wedding and the bigger the bridal party, the less likely it is that the marriage will succeed. And in my own personal life, I've seen that as well. So you might want to do that. If you actually need to come up with the money, Robert, please don't sell the car. You'll never know when you'll find that again. And who knows, that car has already lasted longer than a lot of marriages that were originated on the day that that car was built. So I'd much rather have you go back, get a new mortgage, get the 80% loan to value, extend it out for 30 years, get the cash that you need, and yes, you can get a lower interest rate, and then you can pay it back as slowly as you want. And that's a much better way to help the kids without damaging your own financial situation, nor having to give up a prized possession.
Sound good, Robert?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, keep that car. Wow. That's what a great call. Thanks very much, Robert, for it. Glenn in Oshkosh is with us now. Hello, Glenn.
Hello.
Yes, what's your question?
Well, my question is, when things were starting to be considered in a downward trend with the stock market, I participate in a deferred compensation program with the state of Wisconsin. And I moved all of my money out of the stock market portion, which was, the stock market was at about 13.3 at that point, and I put it into a fixed stable value fund, which earned only about 0.6% this last 3-month period and averages about 2% over a year long period. I'm wondering if you think that's a good idea to keep it in that stable value fund, or to wait for the stock market to decline and put it back into that declining stock market at that time. I know you're not a wizard with the projections, but I'm curious as your thoughts.
Kevin, you are so a wizard.
I am so a wizard. I am never wrong. I'm often early, but never wrong. No, just wait long enough. I'll be right sooner or later. Yeah, Glenn, that's a great question, and it's a common one going through people's minds, and I wouldn't want to have you divulge enough details about your personal situation on the air to give you what I would consider a qualified answer just for you. But that said, the stable value funds aren't perfect, but they can be pretty good. If you said, I really want to get into this, I'm worried I'm missing out on a big run in the stock market here. Well, as you mentioned, we've already had a big run. We've had 4 years where the stock market has basically doubled according to the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So if you really want to get into it, my offhand advice is to keep the money you have in the stable value fund where it is and then make all of your new contributions into the stock market. But be warned, you might be buying high and may have to sell low at some point down the road.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, I am close to retirement, and that's another kind of consideration. I hate to take too much of a risk at this point in time and you know, lose. So.
Yep, I agree with you, Ben. I think safer than sorrier is a good way to go here.
Thanks, and good luck, Glenn. Bruce in Duluth emails, what's your opinion of prepaid 529 plans? As I understand it, these typically allow a student to choose from more than 300 colleges and universities around the country. The tuition is prepaid, and the amount of credit is issued depending on the age of the individual at prepayment. What do you think?
I think they can be a good idea as long as you guarantee that money will grow at the same level of tuition. And that's been a difficult matter for a lot of schools lately. And what's even more of a bigger risk is trying to tell a kid, hey, you can't go to this school that you've dreamed about. You have to go to this one that we've already bought in advance. And it's kind of like saying to a kid, you know, you can't go to spring break at Daytona. You have to go to Branson, Missouri, because we already, you know, have a timeshare down there. The kid might be amenable to it, but I just as soon have you save on your own instead. Typically, if the tuition rises too fast, the investments within the prepaid plan can't keep up with it, and the schools are forced to usually discount it and say, you know what, okay, we can't pay for the whole tuition out of this prepaid plan.
That leads us to the website of the week, Kevin.
Absolutely. It's one of our favorites. As we mentioned before, fafsa.ed.gov is the source of the free application for financial aid from the government. This is where all financial aid starts. Almost every school makes students put this together. If you have a student or you are a student who's going to school in the fall, you should do it sooner rather than later, because a lot of this aid comes on a first-come, first-served basis. And even if you don't have your taxes done, make estimates, and then you can go back in and put the actual numbers in for it. And they even have a FAFSA forecaster. So if you have a kid, let's say a 16-year-old who won't be going to school for a few years, but you want to see how much financial aid your family might receive, the FAFSA forecaster within the FAFSA.ed.gov site will allow you to do that on kind of a cursory basis. And again, we'll have both of those websites up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Sounds good, Kevin. Well, I hope you stay warm. Put another log on the fire, huh?
I shall. Thank you, and same to you.
And for more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Thanks very much to Cynthia Schuster and to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. A reminder, if you would like to take part in a possible future segment on spenders versus savers here on Your Money, you can send us an email with your contact information. Send it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.